And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
And welcome, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. You have now entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. And I am your sensei and host, Gary Matuta. It's great to be with you today. And we got a great show in store for everybody. As always, you know, this is packed with info, packed with technique building skills, all sorts of good stuff to help us explain and defend the faith with clarity, charity, and confidence. And today, let me read you a book title. Does God Exist? The Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. Now, if you just went by that book title, you would think it's probably pretty thick, very pedantic, very heady philosophical arguments. Not exactly the type of book that you could just sit down and breeze through. But folks, you know, the thing is, this book, there is a book by that same title, written by Matt Fradd and Dr. Robert Delfino, which is, I think, the exact opposite. It's actually a really fun read. It's a dialogue between Lucy, a Catholic, and AJ, an atheist. And they're in a coffee shop working through Aquinas' proofs. So for its program, on the other side of the break, we're going to talk with Dr. Robert Delfino about this book, how it came about, and maybe dive into some of the different areas that it examines. But it's a fun book, and I always love it when something as heady as St. Thomas's Five Ways for Proofs for the Existence of God can be boiled down into something that's very understandable and even pretty entertaining as well. So he'll be coming on the other side of the break. And as always, we have our critical thinking skills. Since today's Friday, you know, usually we have our Finding the Fallacy where we examine an informal fallacy. But since it's Friday, we dive into propaganda techniques. And the technique we're going to look at is transferring value. And also we meet one of the early church fathers. And today's early church father is Saint Athanasius. Big father. And in fact, we're going to talk a little bit about his works because, quite frankly, his bio is so long, I couldn't possibly squeeze it in this first segment. So anyway, if you have a question for Dr. Delfino, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or you can always send your questions to questions@handsonapologetics.com. That goes directly to me. And I do answer all the emails. So not all of them get on the air, but I do answer them. And without further ado, let's give our shout-outs, shall we, to the social media section of the dojo. Hello, everybody watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. And thank you. Very colorful emoji explosion today from that section of the dojo. I appreciate it. And also, you know, I want to welcome all of you listening to Catholic Radio from coast to coast and outside the United States as well. Everybody's welcome in the dojo. You know, we all learn together. And God willing, you know, we'll be good tools in the hands of God to help explain, defend the faith. So without further ado, why don't we jump to our Finding the Fallacy? And like I said, today we're going to look at a propaganda technique. And the propaganda technique is the transference of value. Actually, you know, I should probably begin by defining what's propaganda. Propaganda, in the negative sense of the word, is a kind of unsavory or underhanded way to manipulate people to do or think something that does not, without proposing an argument or evidence for that belief. So it's a way of sneaking in under our critical radar screen to kind of make us do or believe something without actually proposing anything. And like I said, today's propaganda technique is the transference of value. And this is an interesting phenomenon that often when things are set next to other things, we tend to transfer value. We tend to look at them as a group. For example, this occurs a lot in the political realm. you'll see TV commercials where you have a candidate next to American flags or a candidate next to military entourage. And the idea is that whatever favorable feelings you have for the flag or the military or whatever is transferred to the candidate. So you begin to associate them with the background. And this is done on purpose because they're really trying to communicate a message without actually giving evidence for it. I think the most prominent one, if you ever seen a candidate and they have this what's called a wall of people or a wall of faces behind them, and they're people of different nationalities, they look different, they may look common, they may look rich or whatever, and they're all behind the candidate nodding their heads like bobbleheads as they're giving a speech. Well, that's done on purpose because they want to have their candidate associated with the people behind them. And so all the people that are there on camera are there specifically and purposely to communicate a message. So just be aware of that. And by the way, it doesn't necessarily have to be a transference of positive value. It can also be a transference of negative value. So they might juxtapose perhaps the candidate they're running against with a picture of Hitler or something like that, or somebody who's not favorable in the public limelight. And the idea is that the negative value transfers to their opponent. So that's our finding of the fallacy, i.e. the propaganda technique today. That is the transferring of value. So be aware, folks, that's the thing about propaganda techniques is when you realize it's being used, that's when their power disappears. It's when you aren't aware of these techniques, that's when they have the power to persuade you without evidence or argument. So, very good. Let's jump now to the Meet the Early Church Father today, who is St. Athanasius, who was born sometime around AD 235, died around AD 373. And like I said, his biography, I really recommend that you pick up a bio of him because his life is amazing and amazingly complex. He's a great early church father, an orthodox defender of the faith. And so I'm just going to give you a summary and then talk a little bit about his most important works, because I think that's about all we can do in one segment. St. Athanasius was born near Alexandria, like I said, around the year 295 AD. He was ordained a deacon in 319, and he accompanied his bishop, Alexander, to the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, serving as his secretary. In 328, he succeeded Bishop Alexander to the See of Alexandria, and his career, he basically was the champion of the Nicene doctrine, which affirmed the consubstantial unity of the Father and Son, that they're both one in being, one in substance. And against the Arians, which was an incredible big threat, which denied that the Son is the same substance as the Father. In some ways, the Son is lesser than the Father. And Athanasius was a fierce champion of the Nicene Creed, Nicene Council, against the Arians. And as a result, he was exiled from his see five times, if you can believe it, until he finally regained his place again in 366 AD. And his last years, until his death in 373, were spent in comparative peace. So a very rocky episcopate, but nevertheless, he never gave up faith. He was a champion of orthodoxy. And like I said, if you can get your hands on a short biography of St. Athanasius, I highly recommend it. Just the perseverance, the suffering, and his unwavering fidelity to the church. Just beautiful stuff. Now, like I said, what I'd like to do is go through some of his writings. He wrote a lot, and some things I think every apologist should know about. He wrote Treatise Against the Pagans in 318. He also wrote a treatise on the Incarnation of the Word. And St. Jerome believed that these were really two parts of the same work. Like I said, both of them written roughly around 318. He also has an encyclical letter to all bishops everywhere in 339. Now, this encyclical letter that he wrote is Athanasius's earliest extant polemical writing, belonging to or about the middle of 339. And it's a call to all bishops and his fellow ministers to regard his case as their own and to assist him in rescuing his churches from Gregory, the usurping Arian bishop. Okay, so that's his first defense. He also wrote several letters concerning the decrees of the Council of Nicaea, which is very important. He also wrote a letter on the opinion of Dionysius the Great. We're not really sure exactly when it was penned. It was probably about 350, 351. And it generally appears as a manuscript as an appendix to a letter concerning the decrees of the Council of Nicaea that I just mentioned. And it is only as a convenience and not as any real conviction that he frequently assigns the same date to the same letter, again, 350. Might be said that these are probably the least likely dates of all. And this, by the way, is Jurgens, Faith of the Early Fathers, that I'm reading, in which he defends the orthodoxy of Dionysius, who was kind of being co-opted by his Arian opponents. But I think one of the most amazing, I'll give you two of the most amazing things he wrote. The first one's called Discourses Against the Arians. This is written between 358 and 362. It's the first three discourses are from Athanasius. The fourth one is spurious, but it's included to the collection. And there he hammers out a great defense of the Trinity and also his classic on the incarnation of the Word of God. Those two, I think, every Catholic apologist should read. It's amazing work. And coming up on the other side of the break, Dr. Robert Delfino, and we're going to talk about Aquinas' Five Ways in Dialogue. Stay tuned.
This is Jesse Romero.
And I'm Terry Barber.
From the Terry and Jesse Show. And we invite you to listen to the Holy Hour of Power, High Energy Catholic Radio. We're two Catholics with a PhD in common sense. We're on Monday through Friday on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
What we're going to give you is masculine Catholic teachings on the faith. You know, we say we're too inspired to be tired, we're too protected to be dejected, and we're too renewed to be subdued. Why? Because we believe in Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church. And we will take each issue of the day and show you how the Catholic Church has the answer for our culture. What we really do is bring men back into the Catholic Church, which it's about time to do. We want men to be leaders in their Catholic faith so that they can bring their family to heaven.
Our program is not right versus left, it's right versus wrong. And our program is where Catholicism and culture intersect. It's High Energy Catholic Radio.
We're going to inspire you to fall deeper in love with Jesus Christ. Christ and His bride, the Church.
The Terry and Jesse Show on the Virgin Most Powerful app.
In 1 Corinthians 13:13, St. Paul says, "So there abide faith, hope, and love, these three." According to St. Ignatius of Antioch, faith is the beginning and love is the end. And God is the two of them brought into unity. Then comes everything else that makes up a Christian. May God grant that we may attain all the virtues that make for authentic followers of His Son.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Does God exist? The Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of St. Thomas. We are going to talk with one of the two authors of that book. We're going to talk with Dr. Robert Delfino. And Dr. Delfino received his PhD from the State University in New York at Buffalo, where he specialized in metaphysics and medieval philosophy. His current research interests include metaphysics, ethics, and relationship between science, philosophy, and religion. And as I said, he's the co-author of Does God Exist? The Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. Dr. Delfino, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, Gary. Good to hear you. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, hey, thank you for coming on. You know, Doctor, before we begin, whenever I hear somebody got a doctorate in philosophy, I know there has to be a story behind how you got interested in that. Was when you were a kid, were you reading Socrates, or how did that come about?
You mean how I got interested in philosophy? I thought maybe you had a story about getting the PhD. There's a ton of those, too.
Yeah, I bet.
Actually, let me tell you a funny story about the day I defended my dissertation, and then I'll tell you how I got into philosophy. So real quick, get a load of this, okay? Usually how it works is after a certain amount of coursework, you have to produce around a 200 or 250-page dissertation. Mm-hmm. So after 7 years, my day arrived, and I had to orally defend my dissertation. Now, there's three people on dissertation committee. One of them couldn't make it, but that's okay. He read it, and he liked it. The other one was my chair, who had looked at it many times and was fine. And then there was another person. Anyway, to show you how crazy life can be, the other person on the day of my defense said, yeah, well, you know, it's fine, but the style is not very exciting. Can you rewrite the 200 pages of style in the next few weeks before you submit it? And I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? The style? What is this? It's not a romance novel. It's okay. But the good news is I didn't have to do it. I got my PhD and whew, I survived.
Yikes.
My Christianity was tested that day. Okay, I have to love everybody, including my neighbors, even though the Italian in me wants to get lead shoes. Now, anyway, about philosophy, you weren't expecting that story, were you?
No, I wasn't.
when I was in, I went to public school, you know, non-Catholic school my whole life. And when I was in high school, I really did enjoy science, biology and chemistry and physics. They're all fun. Well, actually, chemistry I always struggled with, but biology and physics I really like. And but I realized one day that they're not answering the questions I'm really interested in, like, is there a God? Is there life after death? What's the meaning of my existence? What should I be doing in this world, in this life? So when I did go to a Catholic school for undergraduate, this was St. John's University in New York, where I teach now. Everybody has to take several philosophy courses there as part of the core curriculum. And when I took my first philosophy course, I was like, this is it. This is what I've been searching for. And so that's how it all happened.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. Was it the material, or did you have a really good teacher?
Well, I had a good teacher. But I had been searching for a middle way. You know, look, there's nothing wrong with scripture scholars. Scripture is beautiful. It's great. But at that point in my life, I wanted a rational way to try to understand God as much as I could. And the natural sciences just don't do that. So it seemed like, well, there's scripture over here, and that's nice, but I'm looking for a rational way. And then these natural sciences over here, and they're cool, but they're not giving me what I want. But philosophy is that middle ground. It gives you the rational understanding as much as possible of God.
Yeah. Yeah. And that also bleeds into, you know, theology and also science as well, to some extent.
Well, the philosophy. Sure. Yeah. I mean, theologians have to use philosophy, and there would be no modern science if there wasn't already a philosophical base for them to build on, which they did.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Well, you know, it's funny you bring that story about style, because I was thinking, you know, I look at the title of your book, Does God Exist? A Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways. You don't think this is going to be the book for me. It's going to be a fun dialogue. There's, you know, it's going to be a page turner. You think it's going to be, you know, pretty heavy duty lifting, but it's not. I mean, I think maybe you fulfilled, maybe that was prophetic that, you know, redoing your dissertation with style. This is a very stylized, very accessible way to get into Aquinas' Five Ways.
Well, I have to give out a shout out to Matt Fradd. He was very kind to invite me on board to help him with the book. In the end, we each wrote about half of it. And it was his idea for the dialogue format. And I find it works very well with my undergraduate students and with other people, because philosophy is very complicated, as I'm sure you know, Gary. And often when somebody makes an argument, you know, you think, well, what about this? And the dialogue format allows you to almost instantly address the objection in the next paragraph or two. So it worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. How did it come about? Did Matt reach out to you? Did you reach out to Matt?
So here's the quick version of all of that. It was in the summer of 2016. Well, there's always the long version too, but here's the quick one though. In summer of 2016, I was actually at a philosophy conference in Long Island, and I got an email. It was from Sebastian Mahfood, who is the owner of En Route Books and Media, who published the book. And Matt had submitted a manuscript to Sebastian, but Matt said, look, can we get another Thomist philosopher to take a look at it, you know, get some comments and see if it's all right. So I had a version of the manuscript and I started reading it. And I liked a lot of what Matt did, although I disagreed a bit with his take on the third, fourth, and fifth ways. So I called him up on the phone and we're talking and he was wonderful. And I said, well, you may want to do this and here's some suggestions. And then he says, and this was so kind of him, he says, Robert, why don't we co-write the book together? And I was like, oh, okay. And I spent the next 18 months with him working on it.
Nice. Yeah, that's perfect. Was it really labor intensive? Because I know, you know, as a professor, I'm sure you had classes and lots of other things to do. Or was it real easy? Was it easy to work in that kind of dialogue format?
We mean the actual writing as a dialogue or doing the research behind the philosophy? Which one are you asking?
Well, I knew that you had the philosophy chops, but actually doing the work and sitting down and, you know, and typing all of it out, was that intensive or was it really easy because you've done it a million times?
Well, let me say two things. So I did, at the time I was working with Matt on this, I had been teaching philosophy for about 20 years. So, and I knew quite a good amount of Aquinas, but there's always more to learn. I did do some additional research because there, the fourth way and a few of the other ways, there were always some aspects that always bothered me and I never fully understood. So I did have to do a good amount of research. But writing in dialogue wasn't a problem for me. I used to be an English major, actually, and I always loved writing short stories when I was a kid. And I actually used to write a few very short, like two-page dialogues as writing assignments for some of my classes. So that actually came naturally.
Okay. Yeah, nice. Yeah, well, I tell you, reading the book, you can't tell. I mean, it was seamless. I couldn't tell. You know, sometimes if there's more than one author, it kind of changes voice and perspective. But the book flows nicely, so you did a great job.
Well, that makes me feel great. I try actually to be like a chameleon in some ways, like adapt to Matt's style and try to think in that mode. It's almost kind of like acting for an actor, but it worked out. I mean, the fact that you thought it was, you know, written by one author was seamless. Really, thank you so much. That made my day.
All right. Awesome. Because, yeah, I agree. And by the way, you know, for those who aren't familiar with Matt Fratt, he is a very punchy presenter. We've had him on the show. Just a very entertaining and a pretty deep thinker as well. And so you do get the Fratt kind of humor. But like I said, it works perfect. So let's set up the book a little bit. It's a dialogue between Lucy and AJ in a coffee shop, which I think is that's the perfect place to have a dialogue on, you know, proofs for the existence of God, isn't it? How did that come up? Was that Matt Fratt's original idea?
That's all Matt Fratt's idea, the coffee shop and the name of the characters. By the way, Matt hid within Lucy's name, you know, light. It comes from the Latin for looks. Like, you know, obviously she's the one defending Aquinas in the Christian perspective. Now, AJ, he just called, from what I understand, he just called AJ, you know, like an average guy's name. Uh-huh. But I commented to him, you picked a good name, Matt, because AJ reminds me of AJ Ayer, one of the famous British atheist philosophers.
Yeah, positivist, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's funny. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
very
good.
Yeah, and so these two meet, you know, set up for, I'm going to spoil the book. But the two meet in a coffee shop. And so they both are aware of the other person's position as far as, like, Lucy has read Dawkins' The God Delusion. And AJ, I believe he was familiar with Aquinas. Is that right?
Well, he knows a little bit about Aquinas. For example, Richard Dawkins spends two or three pages trying to demolish Aquinas' five ways in The God Delusion. So AJ's the kind of guy who's read that and thinks, of course, that Dawkins is successful. And he's also the kind of guy who's probably went on YouTube and also went on the internet to read what, you know, critics of Aquinas say. But he doesn't know a lot about Aquinas' philosophy like Lucy does. She's learning Latin. She's a graduate student getting her master's in philosophy. So she's dived a lot more into Aquinas than he has.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of cool because they will go back and forth and they'll make references. But, you know, the one thing that first stuck out is exactly what you said. In the dialogue format, it's so easy to kind of go off and hit some of the side issues that not necessarily is part of the proofs. But, for example, at the beginning, you address this idea of scientism, that the only reliable information we have is what science can tell us.
Right. There were a few reasons for that. I mean, the main reason for that chapter is Thomas Aquinas only gives two main objections against God in the Summa Theologiae. One is the problem of evil. Why is there all this evil and suffering in the world if there's a good God? And the other one is, well, maybe we don't need God because nature is sufficient. And obviously, science and people like Richard Dawkins are very popular nowadays. And some of those critics make it sound like, well, we don't need any of these other explanations. Science can explain why nature exists and does that and X and Y. But so I felt they had to be addressed. That was also Matt's idea to follow the Summa Theologiae on those two points. But we live in a world, look, where science is so revered that we had to have that chapter. And I just want to say for the audience, of course, science is wonderful, but it's like a screwdriver and a hammer. They're great for certain tasks, but you can't use them for everything, like to brush your teeth. So, you know, we need philosophy too.
Yeah, well, it depends how bad your teeth are, I suppose. You're right. Yeah, you know what? That's funny. You're right. Those are the two objections Thomas gives. But, you know, when I was reading the book, I wasn't thinking about the actual article in the Summa Theologica. And I thought, you know what? This is exactly the first two things that would come up in a normal dialogue. It would be, well, doesn't science explain everything? And what about evil? So it's funny how Aquinas anticipated that.
Well, look, he was a genius. Athanasius, who you talked about earlier, was fantastic. But Aquinas is in his own league. He's like the Mariano Rivera of philosophy and theology. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, so it starts off with a bang, you know, immediately jumping into, well, doesn't science explain everything? And then he went into problem of evil. And actually, I see the break's coming up. Let's talk a little bit about that on the other side of the break. We're talking with Dr. Robert Delfino about his book on the Socratic dialogue on Thomas's five ways. Stay tuned, folks. More to come on the other side of the break.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist, and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered. It's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, Escovina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Leviticus 11:44 says, "Consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am holy." St. Vincent Pilate said, "You must be holy in the way God asks you to be holy." God does not ask you to be a Trappist monk or a hermit. He wants you to sanctify the world and your everyday life. May God show us the path to holiness and help us to follow it all the days of our life.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome, everybody. We're chatting with Dr. Robert Delfino on his amazing work on Does God Exist? A Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. And, yeah, Dr. Delfino, boy, you start the first major portion is, I think, on the problem of evil. And I have to confess, if I were writing this book, I would start the subject and then fall into complete despair. I don't know how you were able to encapsulate like a good defense against the problem of evil, you know, so simply and, you know, short, in such a short format. Was that really hard to pare down into a dialogue format, or how did you choose what to leave out and what to include?
So Matt's original version of the chapter was actually pretty good. I did add a few things. You know, it's funny. I'm happy that you thought it was a good chapter. I think it's a good chapter too, especially for this kind of a book. You know, it can't be like 30 pages.
Yeah.
Some criticism I've received is that there are things that we don't treat, and that's true because it's a short little, I don't know, what is it, like 8 or 9 pages. So yeah, I was pretty happy with it. I mean, the big point, there are several key points. I mean, obviously, God giving us the gift of freedom is a big part of the solution. Because, you know, if God wants to create creatures that have genuine freedom, well, he's actually allowing them to make choices. And he can't just stop them from making all the bad choices or grab their hand and literally stop them from harming people, because then they're really not free, right? He's giving it and taking it away, and that's some kind of irrational behavior. So the free will part I was pretty happy with in the book. If I could do it again, I might add a little more about non-moral evils. Like, for example, you know, in Pompeii in Italy, there was that big volcanic explosion and the whole town was destroyed. Many people were killed. But, you know, that's a natural occurrence. And on one level, you know, a volcano might seem evil if it destroys a town. But if you think about it, like take Hawaii, right? It's one of the top vacation spots in the world. Well, volcanic eruptions made those islands, which also allow people to inhabit them. So it's not like it's evil in itself. It's, you know, if you're in the wake of a volcanic eruption, you're in trouble, but you can also use the benefits of it. So I wish I would have addressed that part a little more. But other than that, I was pretty happy with the chapter.
Yeah, that would be a chapter that it would be tough to figure out what goes in, what stays out. Because I think it would just spider into like all sorts of different issues. So, yeah, kudos to that. That was a nice, tight chapter. And then, you know, and like I said, what's beautiful also is that you segue into some, you know, kind of offbeat but very popular things like the God of the Gaps fallacy. AJ seems like a pretty realistic non-believer, because that would certainly come up very early on about what is the God of the Gaps and how do we answer something like that?
So two things about God of the Gaps. One of my happier moments in penning something in this book was when I reversed it. I don't know if you remember, I talk about, what was it? Is it the atheism of the gaps, or showing you can reverse it? Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
When Lawrence Krauss talks about a universe from nothing, now you have a gap. You have nothing creating everything, and that's absurd. So let me take a step back. The God of the Gaps criticism is that, goes something like this. In the past, scientists couldn't explain something about our world. And so it was a gap in our explanations. And so some people might say, well, God does that. Of course, this is not a very reliable way of arguing, because if a few centuries later, science does find out how to explain that gap, well, now you lose that argument, right? But mm-hmm. My point would be that God of the Gaps attacks are often just irrelevant. And I'll tell you why. People who bring up God of the Gaps a lot, the atheist objectors and the agnostic objectors, they seem to make a bad assumption. that there's only one level of causality, and God and science are fighting to do the same thing. But that's the wrong way to look at it. You have to look at it like there's two levels of causality that work at the same time. So let me give you an analogy. When I drive a car, there's actually two levels of causality. I'm the one turning the steering wheel, and I'm also the one putting my foot on the gas pedal. So on one level of causality, my intelligent and free choices are determining where this car is going. Are we going to California, which would be a big mistake because it's high taxes, or are we going to, you know, Florida to visit family? So that's one thing. But there's another layer of causality. It's the car itself. It's the engine, the gasoline, the pistons. If that breaks down, it doesn't matter that my intelligent level of causality is still there. I'm just stuck, right? Yeah, so right. When you drive a car, there's always two levels of causality, the material level, the engine and all of that, and then the intelligent level, you know, the person turning the wheel and making the decisions. And that's how it is with God. God's on his own level of causality. He's not filling gaps in the nature he made because he makes a good nature. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. That was one of the mind-blowing one of many mind-blowing moments reading Aquinas in the Summa Contra Gentiles. He talks about that there is two causes. There's God and, you know, and also the, you know, the creation. And, you know, to me, it's like, for some reason, you're right. It's people want to pick one or the other, that either God does everything directly or it's nature and there's no need for God. But it's really like certs. It's a candy mint, it's a breath mint, it's two mints in one. Two is really bad analogy.
There you go. No, it's all right.
I'm trying to keep up with you. You have the great analogies.
Nah, not really. But
I'll keep swinging. Eventually, I'll hit one, something that makes sense.
So actually, let me tell your listeners something else that's very interesting. It's very I wouldn't say it's very easy, but it's all, the two levels of causality is easily misunderstood. Now, suppose you and I are moving somebody's big table in their kitchen, and it's really heavy, and I can't move it alone, and you can't move it alone. So the two of us together are able to move it. That would still be one level of causality, right? Because you're doing half the moving, and I'm doing half the moving. But that's not how it works with God and humans. It's not like he's doing half the work, and we're doing half the work. No. What it is there's two levels of causality. He's doing everything on his level, and we're doing everything on ours, but both levels are needed. So actually, that quote you were alluding to at Aquinas, he says that, he makes that point. And so I just wanted to get that out there because When it comes to God's causality and human causality working together, it's really difficult stuff. And I'm glad you were able to get some of it from this book because it's not so easy to write about.
Yeah, no, it isn't. But it's really illuminating, though, because it sheds light on the problem of evil and all sorts of other things. So the first way is the argument from motion. Let me ask you this. Of the different, of the five ways, which one do you think is the easiest for people to grasp? Would it be motion?
Well, St. Thomas Aquinas himself says that the easiest or clearest way is the first way. So you picked a good one.
Okay. but on the popular, of course, with Aquinas, this is, you know, this is nothing to him. But to the average person like AJ, you know, do you think
it's a good question. I'm sorry to interrupt. You know, Michael Shermer, the famous, he was an evangelical Christian and now he's turned new atheist. Well, he was talking about Fazer's book. I think it's the five, Edward Fazer. Go ahead. What was the title again? It's
Five Proofs for the Existence of God, I think.
Right. There you go. Okay. And I'm pretty sure Michael Shermer said he thought that they all failed. But he thought that the one that came closest was the Aristotelian one, which is the one from motion. So it seems even for atheists, that one seems to be like the least offensive or the least irrational.
Okay. So what's a bird's eye view of the argument? If you were sitting at a coffee table, how would you explain it quickly to another person?
Well, it's difficult to do quickly, but I can give you some sense of how it goes.
Well, within 3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes? Okay. So let me take a step back here. Let's pretend that I want to learn the Chinese language. Now, if I were a little boy, if I've never heard the Chinese language, well, then of course I wouldn't want to learn it because I don't even know it exists. So I first have to be activated or actualized by something. Maybe I turn on the TV and there's a great kung fu movie and I hear some Chinese, right? Okay. So now I know it exists, but I can't teach it to myself because I have no knowledge of this. So I have to find a teacher who actually knows Chinese, who can transmit it to me. Right. So the big thing in the first way is actuality and potentiality. I have the potentiality to learn Chinese, but I can't actualize my own potentiality. I can't give myself what I don't have. So I have to seek out a teacher who actually knows Chinese, right?
Okay.
Now, here's where it gets a little tricky because we need to get into hierarchical causes, chains. So what we use in the book, and this was Matt's example, it's a great example. Think about the metal links in a chain holding up a chandelier, right, on the top of your ceiling. Well, each link is dependent not only on the link right before it, but on all of the links before it going up to the actual ceiling where it's anchored, right?
Okay.
That's different than an accidental series where you have, like, say, dominoes, right? You hit one domino and they all go down. But so let's say the 10th domino falling is only dependent on the one that hit it right before that. It's not dependent on the one earlier.
Right.
So – right. Or maybe even a better example would be if I have a son and he grows up, he gets married and he has a son. Once my son's alive, he doesn't need me anymore to make his sons. You know, I could die God forbid, 5 minutes after my son is born and he can grow up one day and have his own kids. So those are accidental chains. What Thomas wants to talk about is hierarchical chains where every member of the causal series is dependent not only on the cause prior to it, but on all the causes prior to it. So basically what you have here is let me see if I can we use another analogy in the book. We talk about gears. So if you have like a system of three gears where I turn a crank and it turns the first gear, which turns the second gear, which turns the third gear, right?
Mm-hmm.
That series cannot go on forever because the third gear is dependent on the second gear turning.
Right.
But the second gear won't turn unless the first gear is turning. But the first gear won't turn unless somebody is turning that crank. This can't go on forever if we see things moving, like some, you know, maybe the third gear is making some Ferris wheel go around or something. If we want to explain the motion we see in front of us, it can't go on infinitely because all of these intermediate gears are getting the power of motion from something else. There has to be ultimately at the end of this chain a first cause that has within itself its own energy and doesn't need to get it from anywhere. And that basically would be God.
Awesome. Hey, perfect timing too. We're talking with Dr. Robert Delfino about Does God Exist? Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of St. Thomas Aquinas. Stay tuned. More to come on the other side of the break.
We got Ernesto from Long Beach.
You know, I just wanted to comment, you know, and I just wanted to thank you guys. And I kind of wanted to encourage people that are listening, maybe that are not donating, you know, because honestly, I got to be honest, I used to think you guys were a little
too over the top,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You
That's
know,
right.
If God gave us a lot, you know, and I have the blessing of listening to all this, and I just want to call all the people, you know, I got 5 kids, you know, and I don't make a lot of money, and I'm still donating to you guys.
God bless you, brother. You're amazing.
We have to do this. We have to do the extra. And it's not even the extra. People see it like it's extra. Kneeling for communion, saying your rosary, saying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. It is not extra. It's what the church tells us to do.
Amen. You're a good man, brother.
30 years old, 29 years old, 5 kids, and I thank you guys. But everybody else, man, get on fire. Fight for the truth, man. I know what I'm telling you guys. There's
I
so
love
many
it.
Out there.
Hi, this is Eddie Chavez, host of Jesus 911. I want to take this opportunity to let you, our listeners, know about an event being held here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. We will be celebrating the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel on September 28th, 2019, beginning at 9 o'clock with Mass in the morning and talks to follow. Ruben Nava and myself will be speaking, so come and hear us talk about St. Michael and Our Lady. Come join us, and we'll see you there.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We are talking about the awesome book, Does God Exist? The Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas, written by Matt Fred and our guest, Dr. Robert Delfino. And Dr. Delfino, that's why you make the big money in academia. You gave a perfect explanation right on the dot for motion. So congrats to you for that beautiful explanation.
Wait, there's big money in academia? I haven't found it yet.
Well, you deserve it, because anybody that could explain the first way that quickly and that succinctly, what a great job.
Well, I kind of heard the music coming and I was trying to help you out. I hate to do philosophy on the rush, though. No, that's okay. But actually, there is one other little dimension I want to give you. It'll just take 2 minutes if it's all right, about the first way.
Yeah,
if I
absolutely.
Can.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So one of the critiques, and AJ mentions this in the book, he talks about Aquinas not really being special because Aristotle had all this stuff and Aquinas is just Aristotle on steroids. But let me show you why we're still not done a little bit with the first way. If we just stop there, that there has to be a pure actuality, a first cause that's pure actuality that transmits whatever it's doing to the other stuff. Well, that would be Aristotle's argument. And he understands actuality as form. So it would be a view of God almost like a form, like an angel, some kind of form or spirit that exists. In fact, Aristotle, who pursued this first way argument, where he talks about getting through the causal chain to the first actuality, speculates that there might be 47 or even 55 first movers, which sounds like a whole lot of gods, right? So yeah, Aquinas, obviously, I'm sorry, go ahead. You were going to say?
Oh, no, I was agreeing with you. That does seem awfully big.
So Aquinas obviously is a strict monotheist. There's only one God. So he can't adopt that first way just like that. And it's not merely for theological reasons. Aquinas hit on a brilliant insight about existence. I think part of the reason for this insight did come from his theological training, right? Because in Exodus 3:14, you know, Moses asked God, "Who shall I tell the Israelites is sending me?" And this is the famous, you know, "I am who I am," you know, God as being itself, right? The great I am. So Aquinas focused on existence. And one of his principles, and I think we could all agree with this, is that existence is what makes everything, whether it's matter or form, actual. Because things are only spoken of as actual if they exist. I wasn't an actual father or dad until my first son existed, right? Mm-hmm. So what he does is he says, when he gets to this pure actuality at the end of the first way, he says, well, if by hypothesis or, you know, conjecture, we were to say that there's a distinction between its being and its essence, you know, the fact that it exists and what it is, right? Because like in human beings, we're rational animals that have existence, right? Or a tree is a kind of plant that has existence. Well, if this first cause was some kind of thing that had existence, then it wouldn't be pure actuality because the essence would be related to it as a potentiality, right? So what Aquinas does is the pure actuality he reaches in the first way is pure being, pure existence. It has no limiting essence. It's not limited like a bird is limited or a human is limited or a turtle is limited. No, it's just pure existence in its infinite power and radiance. And this more corresponds to the monotheism and the Christian notion of God, because pure existence can give other things existence. This is God as the creator of the world.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, because what you end up with is the God of the philosophers, right? It doesn't seem like God, you know, this unmoved mover. It's not an infinite, you know, good, all-knowing, you know, you just have this unmoved mover. But yeah, once you get to that point, then you can kind of pull out or it's embedded in there, all these different divine attributes of what pure actuality would be.
Right.
Yeah, so why don't you do that? Why don't we pull out some of these attributes since we're here?
Okay, so you actually made an excellent point. You know, even with the new existential understanding of the first way, the first way by itself, you know, only gives you so much.
Yeah.
You know, in for example, in the fifth way, Aquinas makes an argument that God is intelligent because there's this beautiful order in the universe, and that requires, things are interconnected in such a way that it couldn't happen by chance. We need an intelligence for it. And it's not merely that they're complicated, by the way. That's one of the objections. It's not merely that they're complicated. It's that they act for an end that is good, right? So they're not merely complex, but everything is ordered for a mutual good that requires, like, you know, an engineer making a car to be safe requires a lot of intelligence and a lot of planning, you know, to make the metal right and roll cages and other things and brakes. And da, da, da. Well, the universe is even more than that, and things act for an end, like, you know, honeybees can go towards flowers and make honey. And even if you put aside evolution and objections like that, electrons are attracted to protons to make atoms, which actually make living things and make other things too. So he argues for the intelligence in the fifth way. And in the fourth way, he also argues for other perfections that things have. So, for example, in the fourth way, I'm not going to give the whole fourth way, but a little taste of it goes like this. You know, we notice that there's a gradation of perfection in the universe. Some things are better than other things. Diamonds and rubies might look beautiful in a jewelry store, but you wouldn't want to be one, because to be a diamond or a ruby means you're not alive, you're not intelligent, right? So cats and dogs are better than diamonds, but they still lack human intelligence, it seems, so we would rather be human. Well, it turns out that the cause responsible for all of these perfections we see in the world, whether it's life or intelligence or beauty, well, the cause can only give what it has. You know, the effect can't be greater than the cause. Otherwise, the effect would come from nowhere, and that's irrational, and that's ditching the whole idea of causes. So any perfections you see in the actual world, whether it's intelligence or life or whatever, have to in some way be contained in the cause of them. So when you add all these five ways together and you give a few additional arguments, you know, whatever is good in this world, God must possess in a higher, eminent way. And so therefore, since humans are intelligent, he has to be intelligent. And since we're alive, now we're alive in a physical way because we have beating hearts and all that, he must be alive in a higher way, a spiritual, eternal way. So you can really get all of the classical Christian notions of God's intelligence and omnipotence from the five ways, provided you take them all together and then you supplement them with some other arguments.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah. So of the five, which do you think is the most difficult to get a handle on?
Well, I've always struggled with the fourth way, but yeah. I want to know, which one do you like the best and which one do you like the least? I'm just curious.
Ah, boy, that's like picking who's your favorite kid, isn't it? I have to agree with you. The fourth way is very slippery, you know, and I still don't think I have a great grasp of it. I like the first and the second and third. I think those are my favorites. The last two. Boy, you know, if you don't handle the last way about, like you said, being governance of the universe, it could end up, you could very easily go trying to prove something that is completely erroneous. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, you're right. I think the fifth one's very important, because, and actually, I think Thomas talks about how that was one of the more popular ones in his time and also earlier than his time. In some ways, many people are impressed by the amazing beauty and intricacy of this world and how things work out. I mean, just a few weeks ago, I had vertigo. My sons are always getting sick, and the cold went into my ear, and it inflamed some of the tubes with the ear. And so when I was walking, it didn't feel right. I felt like I was wobbly, like on a boat in a storm. And I said to myself, wow, it's just we take walking for granted, you know, going down a staircase, saying hi to somebody. The body's ability to do that with the nerves and everything, it boggles the mind, and yet we do it effortlessly, right? So, I mean, there's just so much order and so much beauty in the world. It's really hard to just say that there's no intelligence behind it. It just happened. Really? I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly. And I think especially for non-living things. You know, living things, you could always, I think it's easy to respond, well, it's evolution and all these natural processes and pressures and that. But when it comes to non-living things, that's harder to explain why, you know, there's that interconnectedness that seems to work out perfectly.
Right. I mean, you have to have, like, if the strength of gravity were a little stronger, right, then in the Big Bang, you wouldn't have enough time for the expansion of the universe for planets and life to form. If you strengthen gravity just a little, what will happen is you'll have a Big Bang and it'll expand, but it'll collapse back much sooner and you'll never get life. And if you make gravity just a little weaker, what will happen is the explosion will be more violent and things won't clump into planets and you won't get life. So it's on a razor's edge. And that's just one thing that's on a razor's edge. There's a ton of things about our physical universe that have to be just right. You know, like the resonance in carbon. If it's not just right, stars won't supernova and emit things that we need for life and planets. So, you know, it's just, it boggles the mind. There was an interview where Dawkins was being interviewed once. I think it was by that guy who used to write for Nixon, Ben Stein. Yeah. And and Dawkins said something to him like, well, God would have to be incredibly intelligent to do all this stuff. I think he kind of slipped up. And I felt like saying, yeah, that's right, Richard. You're getting it now.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Boy, this is just flowing. I'll have to have you back on the program because this has been education and a lot of fun. So we'll invite you back. Where can people go? Do you have a blog or is there a place that they can go to pick up the book and other things that you've written?
Well, I don't have a website or a blog. I'm old school in that way. Plus, I have two kids who drive me crazy. But Amazon.com has the book. Okay. And if you go to the St. John's website, you can find my email. If you want to email me, we could always I can contact some people that way. So we could take any questions or maybe next time we'll do something like that.
Yeah. You know, next time we'll take some questions.
Sounds yeah, great. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. That was Dr. Robert Delfino, ladies and gentlemen. And the book, you know, get it because I really enjoyed the book. They're able to boil down Aquinas' five ways in a very easy to understand, fun format that moves quickly. It's called The Existence of God, a Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas by Frad and Delfino. Pick it up at Amazon and, you know, search the web, too, for other things. Dr. Delfino has other programs he's appeared on because he's just a wealth of knowledge and great, great analogies that you can use. Wow. Well, it's already time to shut down the Midwest Command Center here, turning down the dojo lights. It's been a pleasure to be with you. And thank you so much for listening to the program, everyone. Coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk with the Terry and Jesse Show. And also coming up next week, we got a lineup that's great, like Teresa Beam, Matt Swaim, John Mark Rodi, Pat Flynn, and Jeff Kassab. So we're going to be rocking and rolling next week on this thing that I like to call hands-on apologetics. And I hope everybody has a wonderful and blessed weekend. And God willing, we will talk again soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.